it as the default mechanism for allegedly keeping transgender people safe in men's prisons. We use it, you know, to keep death row prisoners in solitary confinement for the duration of their time on death row. We have a serious problem here because people are being tortured in our prisons, in our jails, and people are dying and coming out of prison and killing themselves because this is absolutely an intolerable way to confine people. And I hope that the continued attention to Chelsea's case will affect our policies.
Jay Stranger, I want to thank you for being with us, staff attorney at the ACLU, part of Chelsea Manning's legal team. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Noreen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Ravi Karan, Steve Martinez. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the African Hip Hop Caravan Benefit Show, August 29th, from 3 to 6 p.m. at Columbia International Cup in Portland. All ages are welcome to this benefit show, featuring Mike Crenshaw and Rashid Jamal, to raise funds and awareness for their November trip to various countries in Africa. Again, that's a benefit show for the African Hip Hop Caravan on Saturday, August 29th, from 3 to 6 p.m. at Columbia International Cup. 9022 North Newman Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Peace.
It's the HIP to the HOP, it's the movement. Hip Hop Caravan is the HIP to the HOP, it's the movement. Hip Hop Caravan.
Looking for a career? KBOO is proud to be a co-sponsor of Oregon's 15th Annual Diversity Employment Day Career Fair. The fair will be held Wednesday, August 26th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Ambridge Events Center, located at 1333 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. Participants may interview with over 50 major employers who are recruiting for hundreds of positions. The career fair is sponsored by the DiversityRecruitersNetwork.org. Business attire is required and bring plenty of resumes. More information is available at citycareerfair.com or on the right-hand side of the KBOO homepage at kboo.fm.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard on the web at www.kboo.fm. Stay tuned for the KBOO Tuesday Evening News coming up next.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an explosion yesterday at a Bangkok shrine killed at least 22 people and injured over 100.
A trans woman has been appointed to the White House staff.
And wildfires are expected to continue causing hazy conditions in the Willamette Valley for some time.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 18th, 2015. I'm Doug McVeigh.
And I'm Nicole Weinstock. Samuel Lawson was convicted of aggravated murder in 2005 and sentenced to life in prison. Eyewitness testimony was used to secure his conviction. Defense attorneys said at the time that police had used unduly suggestive procedures to get that eyewitness identification. The Oregon Supreme Court agreed, reversed his conviction, and ordered a new trial. Prosecutors finally dismissed all charges against Lawson in 2014 after he had spent 9 years in prison. Eyewitness accounts of a crime can oftentimes be inaccurate, which can lead to the wrongful conviction of innocent people. There are things that agencies like the Portland Police Bureau can do to avoid these mistakes. KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Aliza Kaplan, a law professor at Lewis and Clark College and a co-founder of the Oregon Innocence Project, to find out more.
In general, eyewitness misidentification is one of the leading causes of wrongful convictions around the country, and 70% the cause of DNA exonerations. And so we know that witnesses mistakenly pick people and say, this is the person who did it, and they're wrong. And it happens all the time, and it's almost always a mistake. And we have more than 30 years of science that's been done to explain why this happens all the time. And because of the science, there's been all sorts of wonderful reforms put in place that have been encouraged by national chiefs of police organizations and our own Oregon chiefs of police. And unfortunately, as this article in the Portland Tribune noted, some of these practices are not being followed. And so the Oregon Innocence Project, because we work in the area of wrongful convictions, we want to make sure that we're doing everything we can on the front end to prevent wrongful convictions here in Oregon. And one of the number one things we should be doing that many cities and states and municipalities around the country are doing are putting in place these policies that even the chiefs of police have been working on and encouraging around the country.
So now the city of Portland, as I understand, is one of those agencies which is which has been resistant to these improvements. What should we be doing? How should they be doing things right?
Well, there's a whole host of ideas that that Portland police and all police should be doing to make sure that when a witness, from the minute the witness is discussing a specific crime that he or she had, you know, witnessed fully or partially, that they're not being encouraged. You know, what happens a lot in these cases is that without even knowing it, you know, police officers are not intentionally doing things, but there's different things by shaking their head or making comments that encourages a witness to pick out of either a lineup or a pack of photos. So the chiefs of police and both here in Oregon and around the country have done a lot of things to take out some of those, you know, basic natural issues that happen, both on the side of the police, what they're doing. So, for example, having double-blind administration, so the person who knows who they're hoping for in the lineup or the photo pack isn't involved in the questioning, isn't involved with the witness. Other things like to discourage the overly confident witness is important, because we know that in a lot of cases, as a witness is getting clues, they're getting encouraged and their confidence built. It's all based on real science. We see it happen in many cases, and hopefully those don't go to a wrongful conviction. But the case of Samuel Lawson is a great example where there was all sorts of things that went on in that ID. Darkness, the witness was extremely agitated. She was witnessing a crime. There was weapons involved. She was asked while she was in a hospital who she saw. There's so many things going on in that case that if they had just followed a different protocol, Samuel Lawson may not have spent all those years in jail when he didn't commit the crime. So we see this over and over and over. The Oregon Supreme Court in the Lawson case has created some new procedures for lawyers to follow. And now it's time that our chiefs of police around the state, not just in training, and including our Portland Police Bureau, really apply these practices. And as I said, they've been used effectively around the country.
Have any last thoughts for the listeners? And where can people find out more about the work of the Oregon Innocence Project?
Great. Well, thanks for asking. The best place to find out about our work is to go to our website, which is OregonInnocence.org. And there you can see about all the work we're doing, our casework, policy reform, practices. And I just want to also add that we absolutely believe that both the Portland police and all police departments around the country will eventually move to these policies that are encouraged by their own chiefs of police organization. So it's our hope that whether it's on cases or policies, that we want to work with all of these organizations to put in place the best prevention to make sure that we don't have wrongful convictions here in Oregon. And again, OregonInnocence.org. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Kaplan. I've been speaking with Professor Aliza Kaplan from Lewis and Clark College Law School. She's the director of the Criminal Justice Reform Clinic there and a co-founder of the Oregon Innocence Project. Again, Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News. Lucid Energy recently launched its first commercial project in southeast Portland and is now generating enough electricity to power 150 homes. The system uses turbines, shaped much like egg beater blades, that draw power from drinking water as it makes its way to the end user. The turbines are small enough to fit inside a city water pipe, and they tap the power of gravity as water flows through. CEO Greg Semler said, We've just been inundated with interest from all around the country and all around the world. Earlier this summer, officials from the South African city of Johannesburg flew to town to see the project firsthand. The technology is attractive because it uses infrastructure already in place and does not generate carbon emissions. The catch is that the installation cost is high, and each installation generates only a fraction of the total power required in a large city. It works best in cities where gravity does the work of delivering water, but even with the low cost of power in Portland, Mike Sturr, director of the Portland Water Bureau, does not consider wide-scale implementation to be cost-effective. It's not a large deal for the city, Sturr said. Technically, it will bring your water bill down a tiny, tiny bit.
Smoke from several wildfires is expected to cause hazy conditions in the Willamette Valley for some time. According to the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, the air is unhealthy for sensitive populations in southwest, central, and eastern Oregon. Smoke is also expected to grow to unhealthy levels in the Columbia Gorge over the next few days. Residents can take the following steps to avoid breathing problems or other symptoms from smoke. Avoid places with highest concentrations, stay indoors and close windows and doors, and avoid heavy activity in smoky conditions. Remember, smoke levels can change rapidly with the weather.
The U.S. Forest Service is using data from firefighters on the ground to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to predict where the heaviest concentrations of wildfire smoke will travel. The pattern prediction program, Blue Sky, is available on the Forest Service's website, viewer.smoke.airfire.org. The smoke that we see in the Willamette Valley is generated primarily by fires in southern Washington. According to the Forest Service, a wildfire that explodes on any given day can push smoke high into the atmosphere. Forest Service research meteorologist Sim Larkin says, where and how high up it goes in the atmosphere means that it will be transported by different winds into different directions. The computer predictions help fire crews time backburn operations to keep smoke away from communities. But Larkin, who's been working on Blue Sky since 2003, sees the biggest benefit for people who have to live with the smoke.
The statewide unemployment rate rose to 5.9% in July, up from 5.5% in June. This is despite a continued increase in new hiring. When the underemployed and those who have given up looking for work are counted, the unemployment rate rises to 12.2%. In total, only 60% of adult Oregonians are either working or looking for work.
KPFK, the Pacifica radio station in Los Angeles, has scheduled a round of layoffs and work schedule reductions. The cuts include 3 staff members, 2 of whom are union members. The remaining 50 staffers will have their hours reduced to half-time. This is a cost-cutting move by the general manager, Leslie Radford, who has been on the job for less than 3 months. The reductions include 3 staff members, 2 unionized, and at least 4 months of reduction to half-time for the station's remaining 50 staffers. Their union, the Screen Actors Guild, and the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, has not yet signed on to the planned reductions.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises.
For Workers Independent News, I'm Joanne Powers. At the end of last week, skilled maintenance workers at Chicago Bridge and Iron in Rockport, Indiana, voted overwhelmingly to unionize, joining the United Auto Workers. Nearly 200 workers at CBNI maintain machinery used to produce steel for the auto industry. The victory came despite a nasty campaign by the company, which hired notorious anti-union firms to engage in anti-union propaganda. Marvin Troutman is a maintenance technician at CB&I.
They were sending, on the border of being threatening, letters to the houses. They tried to bring it to the home front, which was something that it was unprecedented. I'd never seen anything like that before. But everybody stood real strong and stood real tall, and they were smart enough to be able to read between the lines and educate themselves with the truth. Everybody was very motivated. They wanted to get on board and be part of it. 71% victory margin. That's substantial, and it was just awesome.
For many of the workers, for the first time in their lives, they will have the opportunity to collectively bargain for a fair agreement between them and the company they work for.
We get a seat at that table. We get to have some impact on what it is that we're going to have with regards to language and benefits and wages. It's an awesome, just beautiful thing for so many people to get to experience that for the first time. If you want a change, sometimes you really have to make a change. And for us, that change was the United Auto Workers. We wanted a voice in our workplace, and I believe now we have that.
A new report from the Institute for Women's Policy Research and MomsRising.org shows that women will gain the most from changes to overtime rules proposed by the Obama administration. The rule change would allow workers making up to $50,000 a year eligible for overtime pay, more than twice the current limit. Over 20 million workers will be affected. Of currently exempt women workers, nearly half of single mothers, black women and Hispanic women, and more than 3 in 5 women working in service and administrative support occupations will gain coverage and a chance to earn overtime pay. Moms Rising Executive Director Kristen Rao Finkbeiner says women are disproportionately represented in these jobs.
Single moms and moms of color are a huge percentage of the people who are in the jobs that right now are either misclassified or not paid overtime pay. Oftentimes we hear stories from folks about how they got a title change, like to be a supervisor, and instead of being paid more, they ended up being paid less because that exempted them from overtime pay.
For the first time in history, the U.S. labor force is 50% women, but public policies like overtime regulations are stuck in the past.
Moms are now the primary breadwinners, and 40% of all families. Our U.S. Secretary of Labor, Tom Perez, said something that I really love. We live in a modern family economy, but we have Leave It to Beaver policies. This is a policy that's going to lift our economy, it's going to lift families, it's going to lift women.
WIN is made possible in part through underwriting support from the Office and Professional Employees International Union. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And now we turn to the weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos for Community Rights and Dismantling Corporate Rule, produced weekly for the Tuesday Evening News.
Greetings. You're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Today I want to bring to your attention the latest news coming from Spokane, Washington. I've regularly reported in my weekly commentaries over this past year that our community rights movement is not a progressive or green politics movement, but is in fact led to a large degree by old-fashioned rural Republicans and libertarians who adamantly believe that local communities should and do have the inherent right to pass laws that protect their community's health and welfare. The left has hemmed and hawed about local control for much of this past century, imagining that the very idea of local control is somehow by definition oppressive or anti-democratic. This attitude among many leftists and Greens has always flabbergasted me, as it has been clear for decades now that both Republicans and Democrats, Greens and Libertarians, all overwhelmingly oppose corporate rule here in these disunited states of America. And that clearly the most effective place to challenge corporate rule, at least initially, is at the local level. So it should come as no surprise to anyone who's paying attention to the growth of the community rights movement over this past decade to learn that Spokane, Washington, not exactly a progressive stronghold in the Pacific Northwest, that Spokane is the oldest and most active community rights campaign west of Pennsylvania. I did commentaries about their work on February 3rd and February 10th, which you can access at communityrightspdx.org/podcast if you want more of the background of this extraordinary campaign that has now lasted about a decade and shows no sign of ending anytime soon. But today I wanted to catch you up on the latest chapter of their amazing story. The local government and business elite in Spokane have been pulling out all the stops year after year to keep Spokane voters from exercising their state constitutional right to vote yes or no on the community rights ordinance being proposed by the group Envision Spokane. The last attempt to stop it from going to the voters was in 2013, and it's still stuck in court even after a lower court approved it for an upcoming election date. So the campaign organizers concluded that rather than twiddle their thumbs and wait for the judges to decide their fate at glacial speed, they would run a whole new ballot initiative, a Worker Bill of Rights, for this November's election. The Worker Bill of Rights would secure the right to a family wage when working for a larger employer, the right to equal pay for equal work for all, the right not to be wrongfully terminated, and limit corporate power when it conflicts with these rights. I did a commentary about this also on May 12th, which you can access at communityrightspdx.org/podcast. On July 6th, the campaign handed in 1,000 more signatures than was required for it to be placed on the ballot this November. Then all hell broke loose once again. At the July 27th meeting of the Spokane City Council, the elected officials decided to once again interfere with the public's right to vote on the ordinance by placing two so-called advisory questions on the ballot that both insinuate, with no facts, figures, or other evidence whatsoever, that adopting the Worker Bill of Rights will reduce funding for other services and raise taxes. And on August 3rd, Mayor David Condon unilaterally filed a legal challenge to try and stop the Worker Bill of Rights from going to the ballot. The challenge rests on the claim that the initiative is legally flawed, even though the city examiners concluded otherwise. Meanwhile, the Worker Bill of Rights was endorsed by Noam Chomsky, a variety of labor unions, and the Tacoma chapter of 15 Now. Just last week, on August 13th, Superior Court Judge Salvatore Cozza heard legal arguments in the mayor's lawsuit that is attempting to block the people's right to adopt or reject the Worker Bill of Rights. The judge delivered his ruling later that day. In a big victory for our side, the judge denied the injunction against the ballot initiative and ruled that the courts must protect the integrity of the initiative process by not interfering with the people's right to vote. The constitutionality of an initiative is not grounds to prevent an election from going forward, the judge said. Believe it or not, the mayor's attorney from corporate law firm K&L Gates argued that he was doing what he did to protect the integrity of the initiative process and to prevent voter confusion. Go figure. Brad Reed, the campaign manager for Envision Worker Rights, had this to say about the mayor's corporate backers in the lawsuit, quote, "Corporate lobbyist groups like the Downtown Spokane Partnership and the Spokane Home Builders are like the aristocracy in Downton Abbey, who ring the bell expecting to be served by the system. At least in this case, entitled nobility and privilege had to bow to the people," unquote. What a wild roller coaster ride, eh? So now the Worker Bill of Rights will appear in Spokane's general election in November, but we'll have two malicious advisory questions listed next to it on the ballot. And of course, another legal challenge could still be filed against it in the next few weeks. You have to have a lot of stamina to be part of a community rights lawmaking campaign because those people who claim to be our leaders tend to freak out at the idea that in a democratic republic, the people should have any authentic self-governing authority. So you quickly discover which so-called leaders actually support real democracy and which are in office simply to grease the wheels for the 1%. And if you figure out that your local leaders fall into this second category, it's time to start mobilizing the people to oust them from office. I'm crossing my fingers that Spokane voters will have an opportunity soon to throw these scoundrels out of city council. Their behavior has been an absolute disgrace. Are your city council members receptive to the people's will? If not, it's time to do something about it. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org/podcast. You can sign up for my twice monthly news updates at paulcienfuegos.com. You can follow me on Twitter at cienfuegospaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for selections from The Union Edge. This will be followed by QTPOC Talk. Justin and Dario bring you a conversation on queer dating for people of color at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, widespread haze and smoke, mostly clear with a low around 65. Tomorrow, more haze and smoke, otherwise sunny with a high near 95. Today in history, the film The Wizard of Oz opens in New York City in the year 1939. And in 1969, two concertgoers die at the Woodstock Music Festival, one from an overdose of heroin, the other from a burst appendix. The quote of the day is from Emma Goldman, "The most violent element in society is ignorance."
It's 5:25. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The price of liberty is said to be eternal vigilance. But just being watchful rarely does anything to stop the theft of our rights. Instead, the real price of liberty is open defiance, the courage to stand against the oppressors. And the price of that can be prison. Doug Hughes has dared to defy the corrupt plutocratic order that the moneyed elites, both political parties, and the Supreme Court have imposed over us. Dismayed and disgusted that we the people are blocked by big money from having our voices heard and responded to, this Florida letter carrier chose to get heard with one dramatic act of civil disobedience. In April, Hughes flew his homemade gyrocopter across Washington and onto the lawn of the U.S. Capitol to protest the usurpation of our most basic freedom, the right to be self-governing. This was no stunt, no spur-of-the-moment outburst, but a thoughtful, well-planned, nonviolent stand against the tyranny of money. Undertaken in the spirit of Henry David Thoreau and Martin Luther King, Jr., this mailman on a mission was fully aware of and prepared to pay the price of civic defiance. Sure enough, on May 20th, a federal grand jury indicted this messenger of democracy on a mess of charges that could add up to more than 9 years in prison. Far from backing away, however, he's now calling out you and me. "We spend billions protecting the United States from terrorists," Hughes recently wrote. "It's time for Americans to spend time protecting democracy from plutocrats." This is Jim Hightower saying, one time when Thoreau was in jail for his defiance of authority, his friend Ralph Waldo Emerson happened by and asked, "Henry, why are you here?" Thoreau retorted, "Why are you not here?" To be there with Doug in the fight to save democracy from plutocracy, go to democracyisforpeople.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A trans woman has been appointed to the White House staff. Rafi Friedman-Gerspin, a transgender woman, starts her new job today. She is the Outreach and Recruitment Director for Presidential Personnel. Friedman-Gerspin was a staff member at the National Center for Transgender Equality, where she served as policy advisor for the organization's Racial and Economic Justice Initiative. The executive director says that President Obama has long said he wants his administration to look like the American people, and that the first transgender appointee is a transgender woman of color is itself significant. Valerie Jarrett, a White House senior advisor, echoed that sentiment.
Pilots' reports of unmanned aircraft this year have already doubled, according to the FAA. Firefighters in the West have had to ground their operations several times because unmanned aircraft flew too near them. The FAA wants to send out a clear message that operating drones around airplanes and helicopters is dangerous and illegal. Unauthorized operators may be subject to stiff fines and criminal charges, including possible jail time. On July 19th, five private drones forced firefighting aircraft to leave the area of the North Fire, which closed the highway between Los Angeles and Las Vegas, destroying 18 passenger vehicles and two big rigs. In that case, the San Bernardino County Board of Supervisors has offered a $75,000 reward for the identities of the drone's operators.
Until the Supreme Court's June decision legalized marriage equality, Florida's Attorney General Pam Bondi fought it tooth and nail in court. In repeatedly appealing decisions that deny the state's right to ban same-sex marriage, Bondi lost everyone. In the process, the state became liable for paying fees estimated to total perhaps $500,000 incurred by the same-sex couples who challenged the state's laws. But now Bondi is refusing to pay, contending that lawyers who defended the gay couples were not entitled to collect appellate attorneys' fees. The state vigorously litigated this, Jacksonville civil rights attorney Elizabeth White told the Tampa Bay Times. Now they're saying, we lost, but we don't want to pay. Defense attorneys say Bondi should have known she was fighting a losing battle and therefore should not have proceeded with the appeals process.
Four senators who voted with fellow conservatives recently to strip Planned Parenthood of its annual government subsidy have been targeted for defeat in 2016 by the organization. The legislators are part of a conservative threat to shut down the federal government in opposition to the women's health group's funding. The four are Republican Senators Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, Rob Portman of Ohio, Wisconsin's Ron Johnson, and Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania. The senators are being targeted because they are considered vulnerable to defeat. Ads have already begun airing in Pennsylvania, telling voters that Pat Toomey's vote to defund Planned Parenthood puts health care for millions of women at risk. The ad says in part, Republicans want to shut down the government. What would a shutdown mean for Pennsylvania? Planned Parenthood Action Fund President Don Leggins answered that question in an interview she gave Politico. She said that the attempt by Republicans to cripple the organization is a serious and obviously coordinated attack to get rid of abortion in this country, to recriminalize abortion in this country, to destroy Planned Parenthood because Planned Parenthood stands up for women's rights, freedom, and access to care that women and their doctors decide they need.
The White House yesterday announced a minor initiative to assist states in dealing with use of heroin and other opiates. The Office of National Drug Control Policy announced $2.5 million in funding to be spread across 15 states in the eastern United States. The money is part of a broader push, with $13 million in new funds being distributed through the Federal High-Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Program. The HIDA program was created by Congress in 1988 and provides assistance to federal, state, local, and tribal law enforcement agencies throughout the United States. The program was intended to provide support in those parts of the country determined to be critical drug trafficking regions of the United States. There are currently 28 HIDA regions across 48 states, which include more than 17% of all counties in the United States and a little over 60% of the entire U.S. population. In addition to the heroin response strategy, the administration is putting an additional $500,000 into drug enforcement on tribal lands and an extra $1.3 million into enforcement along the southwestern border between the U.S. and Mexico.
New EPA regulations will require cutting methane emissions by 40% over the next decade. The regulations on methane are one part of the Obama administration's strategy to curb greenhouse gases and combat climate change. These targets are consistent with an announcement in January calling for a reduction of up to 45% from 2012 levels. Earlier this month, President Barack Obama unveiled the final version of his plan to tackle greenhouse gases from coal-fired power plants, requiring carbon emissions from the sector to be cut 32% from 2005 levels by 2030.
Samuel Harrell, an inmate at the Fishkill Correctional Facility in New York, died in April of this year. Prison guards at the time told the ambulance crew who took Harrell to the hospital that he had likely suffered a drug overdose. The New York Times reported today that Harrell's death has been ruled a homicide, and according to the autopsy report, Harrell died following a physical encounter with prison guards. Inmate witnesses say that they saw Harrell get beaten by guards, some of whom even jumped up and down on him before finally throwing him down a staircase. Several of those witnesses claimed that they were threatened with violence if they spoke up, and some were placed in solitary confinement. No guards have been disciplined yet, but an investigation by the state police into Harrell's death is ongoing. Harrell, An African American with a history of bipolar illness had been serving time for a drug offense.
And now this from Prison Radio, a brief commentary recorded by Noel Hanrahan, a little something in the style of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Black August. August 6th, August 9th. Black August 2015. Hiroshima, 70 years later, and the bomb still burns. Hi, this is Jan Lahman, your political prisoner voice, coming to you from the federal prison in Tucson, Arizona. I wanted to send out a little thought about nuclear bombs, past and present, about Black Lives Matter, past and ongoing, about the horror of it all as we remember the crimes of U.S. imperialism. Recalling the first and only nuclear bombing of civilian cities, Hiroshima, August 6th, with 150,000 dead, and Nagasaki, August 9th, with 80,000 dead, and the many other wars the USA state has started since. Let's also think about the ongoing murders of Black people by government agents as well as by ragtag racists. Let's be aware of the injustices and repression against people of color by the state machine and by the capitalist system, and the many people poisoned by the ugly and false ideology of white supremacy. But it is August, Black August, and a time to recall fallen warriors, Jonathan and George Jackson first of all. A time to reflect and share with youth and everyone about the history of hard, militant, revolutionary struggle for Black liberation and revolution. It is clear we have a new generation that is gaining awareness and militancy. Yes, Black lives matter. They always have and will. And it is good to see it taken to the streets and beyond. I've always felt Black August is a time of energy and fight back, of history and remembering too, but all directed to the task. The revolutionary struggle still ahead. So I hope all of you are feeling positive and in a fighting mood too. And one parting thought. August 9th is also the International Day of the World's Indigenous People. Amandala. This is Jan Lahman.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
While moving forward in resolving the crisis of the collapsing Greek economy, the European Union now has another whopper of a problem on its hands, a tsunami wave of asylum-seeking migrants from the Middle East and Africa flooding its shores. The EU has approved nearly $3 billion of funding to help member states cope with the flood of migrants. Creating a major humanitarian crisis for the 28-nation bloc, migrants are now arriving in dramatically increasing numbers, a record 107,500 who entered Europe last month. There have been a total of some 340,000 so far this year, nearly three times the size of the influx by this time last year. Affected has been all of Europe from its Mediterranean islands to Scandinavia. In Greece, virtually all of the arrivals are fleeing war and persecution in Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Mired in debt, Greece has failed to support the tens of thousands of migrants to its shore, most forced to sleep outside and live in squalid conditions. Germany, because of its flourishing economy, has become a top destination, though thousands have gathered at the northern French port of Calais, leading France and Britain to cooperate on an attempt to resist the crush of people desperate to get to Britain through the Channel Tunnel. Meanwhile, 2,440 people have died attempting to escape harsh conditions in their homelands, including 49 migrants asphyxiated in the hold of a ship this past weekend, all hoping to find relief in Europe.
India is home to the largest number of hungry people in the world. According to the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, nearly 200 million people are undernourished in India, the highest number for a single country. India runs several government-funded nutrition programs and also has a national food security law in place. But due to widespread corruption, these measures have done little to alter the situation. However, a unique food bank in India's northern state of Uttar Pradesh is effectively fighting hunger at local level. FSRN's Bismala Gilani reports.
In a small room in Bundelkhand area of the northern state of Uttar Pradesh, a group of volunteers is seated around a table. On top of the table is a heaping pile of home-cooked bread and packets of vegetable curry. 60-year-old Tara Patkar is showing the volunteers how to make individual food packages, putting two breads and a curry in each. Just outside the room, a signboard written in Hindi reads, Roti Bank or Bread Bank. Tara Patkar is the manager.
The banks that people usually know deal with money, but Roti Bank is different. It deals in bread, rice, vegetables, and other food items. The aim of this bank is that no one should go hungry, so we take food from those who have it and give it to those who can't afford it.
The Roti Bank began its work earlier this year and initially focused on the people begging for food at the local railway station. Chandabai is blind. She and her family of five often went without food, but now they get it home delivered.
People often ignored our pleas for food, but now with this Roti Bank, we don't have to worry about food. We get enough without even asking for it.
The Roti Bank operates through dozens of dedicated volunteers who go door to door collecting home-cooked food from local residents. They then gather it at their six offices, package it, and then deliver to local residents in need. The bank maintains a register with the details of all those needing their assistance. Haji Mastan is one of the bank's founders.
There are so many poor and homeless people that we know don't have access to food. There are many others who face the same situation, but they don't tell anyone about it. We decided we won't let anyone go without food and made this humble effort.
The Roti Bank began with just 14 families contributing food. But after 2 months, the number of contributing households is now several hundred, allowing the bank to serve more than 500 families. Lali Devi is among the bank's first contributors. She doesn't wait for the volunteers to arrive at her door. Instead, she walks more than a mile every day to personally deliver her donation of food to the bank office.
There is so much poverty here. People are dying of hunger. And if our small contribution to this bank can keep someone alive, nothing should hold us back from doing that.
Uttar Pradesh is one of India's most populous and poorest states. It's also a region where the largest number of communal riots take place. Here, the Roti Bank thus has become a symbol of communal harmony between Hindus and Muslims, who work together to ensure that fewer of their neighbors go to sleep with an empty stomach. For 28-year-old Mohammad Asghar, volunteering at the Roti Bank is deeply satisfying.
What we get from this work is something that we can't get by praying in a mosque or a temple. This is a service to humanity, and there can be nothing more fulfilling than serving fellow human beings.
The initiative is being hailed by both individual citizens and authorities alike. Offers of funding the initiative are pouring in from various quarters, but the bank's founders are turning them down. They say funding may kill the very altruistic spirit that brought the bank into existence. They also fear that donors with vested interests might try to use the work to further their own agendas. The founders hope their work will inspire people in other parts of the country to initiate similar grassroots projects to battle India's rampant hunger. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
An explosion yesterday at a popular shrine in Bangkok killed at least 22 people and injured over 100. The Erawan Shrine is located at a busy intersection near a shopping mall and is a major draw for tourists. Nobody knows who is behind the bombing, but Thailand's prime minister has said that the intent of the bomber is likely to damage the Thai economy, which relies heavily on tourism. A second explosion at a nearby pier today caused no injuries, but did shut down the pier. It is unknown if the two bombings are related.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Tuesday, August 18th, 2015. Hunger-striking political detainee recover from coma and resume his hunger strike. Meanwhile, Israeli troops demolish homes in the Jordan Valley. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian lawyer, political prisoner Mohammed Allan entered his 64th day of hunger strike Tuesday after waking from a four-day coma. Allan pledged to continue the open-ended strike until death if necessary. 250 Palestinians who are being held without charges by Israeli authorities in a prison camp in the Negev desert have decided to join the open-ended hunger strike. Allan, a 35-year-old Palestinian lawyer, slipped into a coma 4 days ago and Israeli authorities had to administer the vitamins and fluids to him. The prisoners who joined the hunger strike on Tuesday represents all of the prisoners who are being held without charges in the Negev camp. The hunger strikers are demanding the end of the Israeli practice of administrative detention, in which Palestinians are held without charges in harsh conditions with no access to legal counsel and often denied family visitations as well. Also on Tuesday, 8 Palestinian civilians were kidnapped by Israeli troops during pre-dawn invasions targeting West Bank communities. According to Palestinian sources, invasions and kidnappings were reported in Hebron City, southern West Bank, the central West Bank city of Ramallah, and nearby Jerusalem. Elsewhere, Israeli troops demolished on Tuesday 12 tents owned by Palestinian Bedouins in Al-Fasayl area in the Jordan Valley. Another 4 structures were demolished by the army in the nearby Al-Ma'abir area. The army said that the structures were built without the needed permissions. The Jordan Valley is marked as Area C, that is under total Israeli occupation control. Permissions to build homes or tents are never given to Palestinian landowners, and water is mainly taken to nearby illegal Israeli settlements that the army allows to keep being built and enlarged. In the past 2 weeks, Israeli army bulldozers demolished 18 Palestinian-owned homes and farmhouses in the Jordan Valley. Palestinian sources said that